Comics podcast. I'm your host Adam, and with me as always is Jordan, my co-host. Jordan, how are you this morning?
I am in a euphoric state this morning, Adam.
All right, don't ruin
it,
why.
Well, I won't ruin it. I'll just say it has something to do with a certain news item we're going to talk about today. So, I couldn't be better right now.
I'm glad to hear it. We also have our special guest for this episode. He's a returning guest. We had so much fun when he was on last time to cover the Batman 66 animated films. Welcome back, Zaki Hassan. Zaki, how are you this morning?
Doing very well. Thanks for having me.
Thank you for joining us again. It means Jordan didn't scare him off the first time, which is a good, it's a plus.
There's still time.
Oh, I'm sure he may just do that today. In addition to the news item that one of the news items that Jordan is so eagerly anticipating, we are talking about Superman the movie today, the 1978 Richard Donner film starring Christopher Reeve that is arguably the grandfather of the modern superhero cinema craze that's happening now.
It's the Segel, if you will, of the modern.
You just forced that one. That was it was good. It was good, but it's one of the most forced. Mind you, I didn't think of it. So well done.
Thank you.
Or else I would have probably done it. But so we are covering that film, and I know that Zaki is a big time Superman fan. Zaki, is it fair to say that Superman is your favorite character?
Very much so.
Okay, now, last time you were on, I asked you, because it was a Batman-centric podcast, I asked you who your favorite Batman on film was and what your favorite Batman live-action film was. So I'm going to do the same thing with Superman. Who's your favorite Superman, and what is your favorite Superman live-action film?
Well, appropriately enough, Chris Reeve and Superman the movie.
Oh, well, let's say there we go. Two for two, and we're actually discussing what your favorites are today, so we're in good shape. let's get right into the news. Jordan, we're going to start with yours, because if we don't, you're gonna burst a vessel. What is it you're so excited about to talk about?
Well, after all this time, we finally have a wedding date for Bruce Wayne and Selina Kyle's wedding. And that is going to be July 4th in Batman number 50. So I really couldn't be happier about this. I mean, so much of Tom King's run has been a dream come true for me as a Batcat shipper. But this, I mean, this right here is the moment I've been waiting for, truly, to see them walk down the aisle. And I'm in a euphoric state. When the news dropped the other day, I literally ran around my house dancing and screaming because I kid you not, I was so excited. So the countdown to July 4th has commenced, and I can't wait.
Awesome. Zaki, what are your thoughts on have you been apprised of any of Tom King's Batman comic run, and what are your thoughts on the nuptials of Batman and Catwoman?
I haven't read it, although I've been hearing good things about his run, so I'd like to check it out at some point. I think it's cool. I'm curious if they're going to do some kind of duck and weave or bait and switch or pick your metaphor. I've been around long enough to see plenty of comic book marriages be hyped up and turn out to be nothing, or to be unwound from continuity. So I'm curious. I think there's a lot of story possibilities if they do decide to make it the status quo. So I certainly don't think it's a bad thing, but I am curious to see if it actually happens, and B, if it sticks around.
I think if there's anything I've learned over the course of Tom King's run, and I mean I've learned a lot over the course of his run, but it's that he's as big a Batcat shipper as I am. So I that's why I have the utmost confidence that this is going to go through, and I could sort of foresee going forward Batman and Catwoman really becoming a crime-fighting couple akin to Green Arrow and Black Canary, for example, and them working together. And we've already seen that a little bit, but I could see that continuing to progress moving forward with them after they get married.
Here are my thoughts on the whole matter. I if I'm going to see Batman marrying anybody, it is Selina Kyle and Catwoman. That's first and foremost. Even though I like to throw the Wonder Woman Batman pairing from Justice League.
Adam
Space just to just to grind his gears a little bit. But if I had my choice, which nobody consults me at DC Comics, so I would pair Batman and Catwoman for sure. And just a note to Tom King and everybody at DC, please make it last for the sole reason that if you somehow change this or swerve, I'm going to have to listen to Jordan crying on, to no end on this podcast. So for my own sanity, please make it stick. But I'm excited. Bring on July 4th, which is the actual wedding date, for two reasons. So I can see what happens, and for the warmer weather here, because it's pretty cold over here.
Amen.
So in terms of our next news item, we're switching to the world of Superman, which is appropriate for our conversation today. First up is news from the DC streaming service, which still doesn't have a name, which infuriates me because I need to know these details. And also I need to know when it's dropping so that I can give Warner Brothers and DC my money. But in the meantime, they've announced that in addition to the live action Titans and the animated return of Young Justice and a Harley Quinn and animated series, we are also getting a live action Superman related series titled Metropolis. Now, the reason I say it's a Superman-related series is because if you read the press release, Superman is not going to appear. It is set in Metropolis before the arrival of Superman, according to the log line, and will focus on Lois Lane and Lex Luthor uncovering the mysteries in Metropolis and going to some seedy places in Metropolis. So, just some thoughts on my end. I am a sucker for Superman related material, so I'm going to watch this. I think Lex and Lois are strong enough characters to captivate my interest, even if Superman is not there. And the reason why I say if he's not there is because I think there's some wordplay going on here. It said before Superman's arrival in Metropolis. It said nothing about Clark Kent. The other interesting thing about this news to me is that it's being created by the producers of Gotham, so Danny Cannon and Bruno Heller.
John Stevens. Oh, I don't think Bruno Heller.
Sorry, John Stevens. Okay,
John Stevens. Yeah,
you're right. I'm a fan of Gotham as an Elseworlds tale, and if you look at it in that lens, for those that don't appreciate it, I think it'll go down easier if you look at it as an Elseworlds tale. So I already enjoy Gotham. So I'm curious to see what they do with in Superman's world. The reason why I'm guessing that there's wordplay going on and that Clark Kent at least will appear, is because Gotham, when it was initially announced, was supposed to be Jim Gordon and the GCPD. Bruce Wayne was going to be shown in the pilot, and then that was pretty much going to be it. And then plans changed, and now it's become as much Jim Gordon's story as it is Bruce Wayne's journey to eventually becoming Batman. So I do think we are going to see Clark Kent at the very least at some point on this show. But Zaki, what are your thoughts on this idea, and where are you with it?
I just reflexively read the premise and I just kind of shake my head, to be honest. I say all the time there's a good version and there's a bad version. I hope we get a show that surprises me, but certainly just looking at the premise, it doesn't sound particularly interesting to me. Having Lois Lane teaming up with Lex Luthor, I don't know. I don't like the trend towards trying to make Lex Luthor a sympathetic guy and sort of making his point of view, maybe a valid one. I feel like once Lex Luthor is in Metropolis, he's the villain. And, it feels a little like they're slicing the onion a little thin, where it's like we're doing it's basically between Smallville and Metropolis and Krypton. It'll be three different TV series that are around Superman without Superman actually being in it. You know, if we think of Smallville's the closest that we get, obviously. But like, you know, I look at it like, hey, you know what? I'm a Superman fan, so I certainly would rather see a good show than a bad show. But
sure.
I kind of just shrug my shoulders.
So even with your trepidation, would you check it out once you see who they cast and
yeah, I'll always give it a shot. Okay. Yeah,
because I know there are some, you know, people in fandom that right off the outset they won't even give it a look, right? And so I know there are reactionary, I guess is the best word, members sure. of fandom who as soon as they hear something that is not to their liking, they're like they write it off before, you know, sight unseen basically.
Right.
So I just wanted to get your temperature on that. Jordan, what are your thoughts on this?
Yeah, I'm actually pretty excited about this. I think it sounds like a pretty cool concept. I'm a big fan of Gotham, so the fact that John Stevens and Danny Cannon are involved that has me excited. I'm really hoping they cast somebody as Lex Luthor who's cold and calculating, so we can finally get another somebody who portrays him similar to how Michael Rosenbaum did. And I'm gonna push back on what you said, Zachy, a little bit. I like the idea of Lex Luthor being like Smallville portrayed Lex Luthor in a sympathetic light because you saw his tragic descent over the course of the show. And so,
yeah, and just to be clear, that's why I say once he's in Metropolis, I think formative Lex Luthor being, you know, sort of the Anakin Skywalker story of the guy. My point is, like, once he's Darth Vader, you know?
Okay. I see what you're saying.
Basically, Zachy's saying what Smallville did was fine because it wasn't full-fledged Lex Luthor from the get-go.
Once he's Lex Corp, Metropolis Lex Luthor, and he's like, you know, everybody should look up to see me, at that point, no, we have to sympathize with Superman, and Lex is the villain. That's me. Oh. I mean, just to be clear, that's just my perspective.
Sure. Okay, I see what you're saying now. But yeah, I'm really excited about this. Of course, we know it's coming in 2019, which sort of the streaming service, we've heard that Young Justice is coming in quarter four of 2018. So this sort of suggests to me that they might be staggering the shows, so we might not get everything starting at once. So we might get the streaming service later this year, and then this show will be one of the ones to drop first. So
yeah, the way I see it going, this is just my headcanon version of the way things go. I would bet that we get Young Justice, which I'm super excited for, and Titans, which everything I've seen personally looks amazing. I don't think we've talked with you about it, Zachy. Yeah. Are you excited for Titans? I mean, have you seen all the
images? I think I've only seen the picture of Brenton Thwaites as Robin. Have they released any other pictures?
Yeah, they have Hawk and Dove.
Hawk, that's right. Yeah, no, it looks great. I mean, yeah. My gosh, it looks like I love that Robin costume that they have Brenton Thwaites in.
It looks fantastic.
It's awesome.
You know, I feel one of the quibbles I've had with live action DC since the 90s is that ever since Chris O'Donnell, they've shied away from acknowledging Robin as a vital and important part of the Batman mythology. And that's something that really irks me. You know, the DCEU, we've seen that one costume.
He's dead. One of them is dead. Yeah.
Yeah. And the Nolan movies just kind of made an offhand joke out of it. And I'm like, you know, Dick
hold
Grayson.
Up, hold up, oh, hold up.
Here we go. Zachy, you just opened a can of worms.
Okay.
Keep it brief. Jordan, we got a Superman movie to get to.
I love the John Blake version of the character.
No. Just, in the context of the film, I don't have an opinion about John Blake. However, what Nolan was doing was saying, hey, here's like our little nod to Robin. And my thing is like, well, I'd love Dick Grayson to be acknowledged as a really vital and important part of the Batman mythology. And, you know, Nolan told his story, and that's fine. It had a beginning, middle, and end. But it's gratifying to me to see a version of DC on film where it's like, hey, look, there's Dick Grayson, and he's in his costume, and he's Robin, and he looks awesome. It's not a critique of John Blake so much as, you know, a critique of Nolan's view of Robin's place in the mythology.
Yeah, Nolan's wink, wink, nudge, nudge. I think calling him Robin to me was unnecessary. But that's
yeah, I agree with that.
It's just like it is what it is. But I think what we'll get is we'll get those two, you know, Titans and Young Justice in 2018, sorry, and then 2019 we'll likely see the Harley Quinn animated series and Metropolis.
And at least with Metropolis, they're doing weekly, so it does look like they're doing what I thought they would do, which is a smarter business move, I think, is to stagger the episodes so that people have to keep subscribing.
Is that?
Yeah. They said Metropolis is weekly. I don't think they've announced it for any of the other shows, but yeah.
Before we move on to the comic news, I will say this: it's going to be vital for me to see first of all who they cast as Lex Luthor and Lois Lane. That's a huge you know thing. And also, I need to see at least a trailer just to see how these characters are being portrayed. And I will say this: the producers of this show have a big hill to climb because, to me, filling in the shoes of Erica Durance and Michael Rosenbaum respectively is going to be a mountain to climb.
Very true.
I wish them good luck.
You know what? Cast Erica Durance in it. I'll purchase 7 seasons in advance on Vudu.
Zachy's going to fund the network. Never mind purchase it.
Done deal. I'll take out a mortgage.
Yeah. I'll join. If there's a way they could do, look, you know, Jordan, I yell at Jordan. Well, not yell at him. I get aggravated when Jordan says, well, connect everything to the Arrowverse. But in this case, like, if you can find some way, even if you don't acknowledge Smallville, and you find a way to bring back Erica Durance as Lois Lane, I'm with Zachy. I'll throw a party. I'll be dancing around my house.
You might be surprised to know that I actually don't want them to do that as much as
Bizarro. You're in Bizarro world. That's
I mean, I'm a huge. Obviously, you know how huge a Smallville fan I am, and Erica Durance is my favorite version of Lois Lane, but. For me, it's just there's something that wouldn't sit right with me about it being not in canonical with Smallville and yet having her return in the role. Like it wouldn't be quite right. And I think that they should just they can find another great actor in for both those roles for both Lois Lane.
It's gonna be really tough. And usually I'm the guy that says, well, I'll give the new guy a benefit of the doubt, and I ultimately will. But it's with these two roles, it's gonna be tough.
They need to find somebody. I don't. It's particularly with Lex. I don't think anybody's ever going to top Michael Rosenbaum for me. I've said it before. He's my second favorite live action villain ever, right after Heath Ledger's Joker. So I don't think anybody will ever top him for me. But if they get somebody who plays Lex as cold and calculating, the way that Michael Rosenbaum did, and so few others do, then I'll be very happy. And two other things I was just going to point out about the series.
Yeah.
The premise of it reminds me a lot of, I don't know if either of you guys have read the Lois Lane prose novels by Gwenda Bond.
No, I have not.
And they're about Lois Lane. She's in high school in those novels, but before Superman shows up in Metropolis. So she's at the Daily Planet as like an intern, and they're really good, actually. I think I've only read the first two. I think there's a third one out now, but anyway, it sort of reminded me of those, so I wonder if they'll, you know, if they'll take anything from those or if it'll have a similar feel to those novels. And the other thing I was going to say is that, and Adam, I know you don't like this idea, but I do think it would be awesome if they made this a prequel to the Superman we see on Earth, if they set it on Earth 38 and it's a prequel to Tyler Hoechlin's Superman. So basically, whoever the Lois Lane is here, and whoever Lex Luthor is, if we ever see those characters on Supergirl, it'll be the same actors playing older versions of those characters on Supergirl. So if they set it within that continuity.
I just don't see it happening, personally. I'm not necessarily opposed to your idea in this you know, respect. I just don't see it happening. But you know, like I said, I'll wait for the cast, and I'll see the trailer, and I'll check out the pilot and go from there.
This is, by the way, I mean, it's very similar to the original premise for what became Lois and Clark.
Right.
You know, because Lois and Clark was originally pitched as a show called Lois Lane's Daily Planet, where we would just hear about Superman. We would never see him, and it would be about...
I didn't know that. Wow.
Yeah, Clark Kent would have been a character, and then he would disappear every once in a while, and we'd hear about... Like, they realized at some point, like, hey, you know, maybe this isn't a great idea.
So, Zachy, don't you think, given what I told you about Gotham, and given that it's the same people, don't you think we're at least going to get, at some point here, you know, if not the first season, by the end of the first season, Clark Kent will become a character?
You know, I think all is possible. I mean, certainly I can't imagine that they intended Lois to become as important a part of Smallville as she ended up becoming. You know, and these things flow, and you know, I remember when I heard they were bringing Lois to Smallville, I was like, really?
I was against it at first as well, and then I'm like, oh,
yeah. And then so I was kicking myself afterwards. I'm happy to be surprised because she is just a joy on that show. So,
and you will get to talk about her more when we do our Smallville, our big Smallville retrospective, because Zaggy is coming on for that.
And he's coming on for one of the seasons she's in. So
yeah, well,
her first season as a series regular, I think, is the one he picked.
And I'm sure he picked that with some purpose in mind as well. So so there's that. But we'll announce more of that when it gets closer. But before we get on to the movie, we actually have to talk about some comics, the source material.
Well, we did already talk about some comics. At the beginning, and then we jumped over to TV.
Right. Okay. Fair enough. But
Superman comics, though.
Yes, Superman comics. Yes. That's right. Specifically, thank you, Zaki, for pointing that out. After Action Comics 1000, Brian Michael Bendis, who recently signed with a multi-year exclusive with DC, and for anybody that doesn't know, Brian Michael Bendis was at Marvel for I think 17 to 20 years or some such number. Of time, and he wrote two of my favorite Marvel runs that I've read, and those are the Ultimate Spider-Man comics, and I can't remember how many issues it was, but he wrote a bunch of Daredevil, and both of those books, when he was on them, were my favorite non-DC comic books. So he's come over to DC, and his first work is going to be Superman related. He's going to have a story, one of the stories in Action Comics 1000. And then following that, he is going to produce a 6-issue miniseries, which will be weekly for 6 weeks, titled The Man of Steel, which is going to explore, it sounds like it's going to explore some of the origin on Krypton and the final days of Krypton and Clark Kent's journey to become, or Kal-El's journey to becoming Superman. And then after that miniseries, he is going to be taking over writing duties on both Action Comics and Superman. As a fan of him as a writer, I am stoked that, you know, my favorite Marvel writer is now taking on one of my top two favorite characters in fiction, period. So in that level, I'm excited. Secondly, look, I know that we've seen Superman's origin 1,000 times and we're going to talk about it in a bit here, but I'm a sucker for the origin story. I make no apologies for that. And I will say, given Rebirth and where we are with Superman, it's gotten a little murky. I don't know what the official canon for Superman is at this point. If he's going to touch on it briefly in this miniseries, I'm okay with that as long as it becomes a clear picture and as long as it sticks for more than, you know, a year. Because, you know, I loved Birthright, but that was canon for about a week and a half. And then there was New 52. And then there was somewhere in between there was the Superman Earth 1 graphic novel. With all three, all of them I enjoyed. It's just, give me one and stick with it. Like, I grew up, my initial foray into Superman comics is the 1986 origin. So that's my go-to. But having said that, I really like Birthright and also the Earth One mini graphic novel. So if they can give me an amalgamation of all three, I'm good. But my stance on that is just give me something with clarity. And then, but then beyond that, I'm excited that such a prolific and writer and somebody that I whose work I admire is coming on, like I said, one of my favorite characters. So I'm stoked about this. Zaki, where are you with this announcement?
Well, I think it's smart to like you said, to sort of clarify what is and isn't, because I mean I've been reading the Superman books since Rebirth and I've been enjoying them a lot, but they did kind of they did a very compressed version of the new canon by Dan Jurgens, I think. But I don't know. I mean, I think if there's an opportunity to sort of streamline things further and draw a line in the sand, you know, I think it's smart. I, like you said, I mean, the John Byrne Man of Steel miniseries is what got it all started for me. And I'm not opposed to another Superman origin story. Like you said, we've gotten quite a handful of them over the last few decades.
But it's around there. It's creeping up.
It's up there. I mean, I really like A Secret Origin by Jeff Johns. Yes. I like Birthright. Mm-hmm. All-Star Superman I really like. So, hey, why not? You know, I'm certainly not opposed to Brian Bendis and seeing what he has to say about it, because I think his Ultimate Spider-Man run is one of the defining books of the 21st century.
Yeah, and you know what's funny is that, with Spider-Man, the reason why I got into Ultimate Spider-Man was because I was trying to get into the main series, but I found it really confusing. So I'm like, I need an entry point where I can just, like, I know the origin story, but I need an entry point where I can start from basically zero and go. Right. And that's what got me into that. But beyond that, I think, his reading the interview, which he did for Forbes and our good friend Mark Hughes, I throw a shout out to him. He seems really passionate about Superman. And that, to me, that's it's got to come first and foremost. Like, I'm tired of hearing writers say, oh, it's hard to write Superman. It's like, well, is it? I mean, is he that hard to write for? If you have a passion for the guy, I don't think it would. I would love to write Superman. Nobody's going to pay me to write Superman, but I would love to do it. I'm happy that he's passionate about it. That's one of the things that brings me, brings a smile to my face. And I think I can definitively say that he's in good hands. Jordan, what are your thoughts on this?
Yeah, well, I don't really have many thoughts, because I have pretty much zero familiarity with Brian Michael Bendis, and I don't read Superman or Action, so
you're fired. No, go on. What are you saying?
I don't have much to say about it. The one thing I will say is that I heard that they're making Action the more family oriented book in terms of focusing on Clark, Lois, and John, and then they're making Superman the action heavy book, which I thought was pretty funny and ironic, given that So anyway, that is literally the only analysis I have of this news.
All right, cool. So me and Zach are excited, and you're in La La Land over there, dreaming of Batcat stuff. Cool.
I'm happy with that. I'm very content in that place.
Your Christmas is coming in July. There's that saying, and now you have it.
you're absolutely right.
All right, boys, let's get to the meat and potatoes of the show, which is the Superman the movie. Jordan, as you always do, give us the ever clever IMDb one sentence description.
Are you thinking one sentence this time?
Yeah, I'm gonna go one sentence. I think IMDb is quite lazy with their descriptions, but having said that, I will say that this is a monumental film, and it's kicking off a bit of a Superman celebration for us on the podcast over the next month and a bit. So. So I'm excited to dive into it. What you got it up, Jordan?
I've got it. Yeah, you were right about one sentence. So
why am I not surprised?
An alien orphan is sent from his dying planet to Earth, where he grows up to become his adoptive home's first and greatest superhero. Directed, of course, by Richard Donner. Written by story Mario Puzo. Screenplay credits for Mario Puzo, David Newman, Leslie Newman, and Robert Benton.
It's a lot of writers on one movie, but I guess it's more common than we think. So what I noticed about this movie is it's really a three. There seems to be like a three act structure going on. So I think we can cover it in those aspects. So, we start on Krypton, then head to Smallville, and then the action in Metropolis. I want to get our temperature on when we came to this movie or how we came to this movie. For me, and it's going to tie back to Smallville, I had seen it on and off on TV. I never watched it, straight through. But when Smallville came around, because like I said, I think I've said it on the podcast before, my initial experience with Superman outside of comic books, in live action, my initial experience with Superman was Lois and Clark. So I had seen this movie on and off, you know, on TV in scattered portions. And then I remember a commercial for Smallville, and this commercial was really weird because it was Tom Welling sitting in a chair, like one of the actor's chairs, and he was in the towel on set, and he was like, watch my show Smallville on, I think it aired Saturday night here or whatever. And the only reason I caught the commercial because it aired in the middle of a hockey game. And so at first I'm like, oh, okay, what is this? It doesn't really give you. But then the name Smallville kept like gnawing at my head the rest of the day. And I'm like, oh, that's Superman. And I'm like, all right, I got to check this out. So then I went back and actually purchased, you know, remember when they had the two-sided laser disc? I purchased that and I watched it. And that was my first full viewing of it. So it was just before Smallville aired that was the first time I sat and watched the thing from start to finish. Wow. What about you, Zaki? When did you first come into into contact with this movie?
Oh my gosh. You know, I was just on the Batman on Film show a couple of weeks ago with Rick Shue and those guys.
I heard that about one. Superman. It was a good show, yeah.
Yeah, and what I said to them is applicable here. You know, I was born in 79, so right between Superman in 78 and Superman 2 in 80. So I tell people I was just born into the Christopher Reeve era of Superman. I mean, yeah. The way in which certainly those first two films depict the character is in many ways inseparable from my perception of him, you know. And obviously the later films kind of took a steep drop qualitatively, but even as I get older, you know, my view of the sequel of Superman 2 kind of goes up and down, but I still think that the first film is really an astonishing achievement in so many ways, not only for what it how it broke the mold, but also for how it paved the road for my gosh, I mean, the entire genre that followed in its wake, you know, and looking at that crucial piece of context, we wouldn't be here talking about a DCEU, and Christopher Nolan would not have had the Dark Knight trilogy if Richard Donner had not in 1977-78 said, we're going to treat this seriously. It's not a joke. And that made all the difference.
Yeah. I definitely agree with your points there, and it's interesting how we caught it at two different way different portions of our life span, for sure. I came to the party actually quite late, in terms of this movie at least. Jordan, what was your first exposure to Superman the movie?
It was nice knowing you guys, because you guys are about to kick me off the podcast.
Oh, I fired you many times before, so another time won't be.
It was fun, guys. No, yeah, I guess I should just come out and say it right now. This is probably going to be my most controversial statement I've ever said on this show, and I know I've said a lot of them.
Right. Yeah. Go ahead. I've braced myself.
I don't care for this movie much at all. In fact, it's my least favorite live action Superman movie, and that's because.
Really?
It is, and it's because of the Krypton sequence at the beginning. Because that, at least the latter three don't have that. Where that is, a lot of this movie bores me. I'm not going to lie, but that is what bores me to death. Is that long Krypton sequence that lasts forever at the beginning of this movie. So that's what edges this one slightly below the other ones for me in terms of the Christopher Reeve movies. None of which I'm a big fan of, to be honest. My favorite thing about this movie is, and this is the most controversial statement I'm going to make, probably ever on this podcast. Is the fact that Virgil Swan, Bridget Crosby, and Dax are in it.
Oh, God, here he goes. You just can't resist yourself.
And Jor-El.
And the voice. The voice.
Yeah, that's true. You forgot the best. Okay,
the Jor-El AI.
My question is, when did you...
I know, that's what I'm leading to. I'm leading to answer your question. And I'm saying because of that, because of the fact that I don't care for this movie at all, really. I've seen this movie maybe 4 or 5 times in my entire life. And one of those is when I just rewatched it in preparation for this. And I did watch the 3-hour cut. So I sat through that entire 3-hour cut, almost fell asleep a couple times. And that's saying something, because I had 8.5 hours of sleep coming into this.
Espresso
and I was burn. And I was sitting in a desk chair. So this movie, is one I saw a couple times as a kid. I saw it probably once more a couple years ago, and then I saw it again in preparation for this podcast. I watched it this week. This was the first time I'd seen
you did see it as a child. That was my.
I did. I think I had it on VHS as a kid, and I saw it a couple times, and it was never one I really wanted to put in ever as a kid after I saw it once or twice. So.
Okay, so since you brought it up, I guess, you know, I said it was a three-act structure, so let's get into it. So with the Krypton sequence, I'll say the things that I – because I do have likes and dislikes with the Krypton portion of it. I do dig the fact that Marlon Brando went for – and I guess, you know, Richard Donner and the screenwriters went for this Shakespearean grandiose kind of verbiage and the way they spoke and just, you know, all that. So I did like that, and I thought – one of Brando's best scenes for me was the one where he's trying to convince the council, you know, that Krypton is facing his impending doom. It's impending doom. I thought that was a very solid portion of his performance. I really liked it. It's like he was really getting into it at that point. Where my issue with the Krypton sequence comes is that first portion where he's sentencing the three Kryptonian villains to the Phantom Zone, it felt to me like he was reading off a teleprompter in those scenes. Like it was just like he's going through the motions.
Which he probably was. Brando was renowned for having cue cards that he would pull.
Okay, then there you go.
So it's entirely possible that your read on that is right.
Okay, then because it certainly felt, I'm like, wait a minute, shouldn't this have more? I mean, I know he didn't have a lot of dialogue in those scenes, but he should have more, a little bit more oomph in his words or something. And then I thought I did like the interaction with him and Baby Kal-El. I did appreciate that. It was just that opening bit with him was so jarring that it just kind of threw me off a little bit. But I do like the grandiose Shakespearean kind of play that they were doing on Krypton. I thought the translucent costumes were a cool choice, very, very like alien and futuristic for the time.
It looked like they were wearing aluminum foil, Adam.
I think weren't Zachy. I don't know. You might know this. Were they?
It wasn't aluminum foil, but it was a kind of reflective material that photographed translucent on camera. But if you see the production stills where they're just on set, it looks like gray cloth.
Okay.
Interesting. Okay.
Really interesting.
Yeah, I thought that was like very, you know, it had a real, you know, like alien kind of sci-fi futuristic look for 1978 terms. And I did notice, I don't know if anybody else noticed, or maybe my eyes are playing tricks on me. The S on Marlon Brando's chest was the George Reeve S.
Very similar to that, yeah.
At least it looked to me.
And by the way, that's kind of, as far as innovations to the mythology, it was Superman the movie. It was the first time where the Superman symbol was the L family crest. That started with Superman the movie. And it happened because Marlon Brando was like, "Hey, I want to wear the S."
Oh, okay. So that's one thing cool that he brought to the table. That's good because I like that aspect of the mythology.
I think it's great.
Here's what aggravates me about the Krypton sequences. We learn next to nothing, in large part, about that society. It's literally. They sentence the Phantom Zone villains. We have Jor-El making his plea to the council, and then it's send Baby Kal-El off and watch a bunch of destruction. That's all well and good, but there's no. I think it's the whole crystalline, you know, aspect of it. I get no sense of the culture that this place had any, you know. Animal life, vegetation, there's none, and I'm a sucker for that kind of stuff. Like, I love seeing, especially when we're going off Earth and we're seeing a new world, I love seeing that stuff, and I get it, it's probably budget-wise why they didn't go that route, but it's frustrating because it's like, there's nothing, there's nothing
you can
here.
Barely
who would want to live here is my you know.
You can barely tell that there is any society. It looks like they all live in igloos, and like it's so it feels so like cold. Yes, like there's there like one thing I noticed was the sound in it. It's just there's no like I've got to compare it to the Man of Steel Krypton sequence because that was so amazing. It's like that has this incredible music and all this, and it's like really intense, and you see all this emotion. That's the one thing. It's so stale. There's no emotion in the Krypton sequence in Superman the movie, whereas like when they're sending Kal-El away, and it's like in Man of Steel you've got this beautiful emotional scene where like Lara is struggling to do it, and there's this of course the beautiful Man of Steel music. Here is just these weird sound effects that are like ooh, like when the hula hoop things are going on with Zod and Ursa. And,
yeah, but we saw those in Smallville too. They had a very similar Phantom Zone-y kind of effect. So, but anyway, go ahead.
I'll reiterate, Smallville still did it better.
Okay, I know. I shouldn't have read you there, but keep going.
And it's like this whole sequence is just beyond anything. And this again, I'll go back to it. This is why this movie is slightly below the other three for me. Is because I have to watch this whole thing, and it's just like it's so boring to me. And there's this weird, and I know this is something that was just in, I think, the special edition and the 3-hour cut. It's weird, like the guy with the weird mask that like shoots around like a rocket or around Krypton. I think Zachy knows what I'm talking about.
He was in part two as well, I think. The guy you're speaking of, Jordan. Are we right on that, Zachy? Is that?
I believe so. Yeah.
Okay. Now, Zachy, what's your because you know. And I will say, I do. I will give them. I kind of dig the whole look of the ship that it looks like. I guess it's supposed to be a representation of this. Is it supposed to be a representation? Because I know Brando was going very Judeo-Christian with the whole thing, in terms of the.
Making the ship resemble a star. I mean, they're hitting you pretty hard with the Christ metaphor.
I kind of dug it, but at the same time, I'm like, that's not practical at all. the problem is watching it with a 2017. I try to put myself in 78, and I can for most of the movie. But I think in this aspect, I'll agree with Jordan. I want to get your take, Zachy. But in this aspect, I'll agree with Jordan. Coming off Man of Steel's opening sequence, it really. I don't know what the word is. It dampers my experience with this version because it's just I love exploring, and this is why I'm so excited for the Krypton show. Is I want to explore more. I want to see the civilization. There was nothing here of that. So it kind of was a little bit of a letdown. What's your take on the whole Krypton aspect of it?
Well, it's interesting because the entire sequence on Krypton, from intro to explosion is about 15 minutes. And that feels like about the right amount of time. I think there's three key scenes on Krypton. We have number one, the sentencing of General Zod, and what that does is it gives us a sense of who Jor-El is as a character, where he cares about justice and things like that. And then obviously it's setting up the enmity with Zod. And then the second sequence is with the Council, which gives us a sense that he stands apart from his fellow Kryptonians. When he talks about trying to spread the word, and they say don't spread the word, and they say Jor-El, be reasonable, and I love Brando's line.
Yeah, that line was good.
I've never been otherwise. I love it. The sequence with Lara and by the way, Susanna York is terrific as Lara.
Yes.
But you mentioned it. I mean, when Jor-El says goodbye to his son, I mean it's a genuinely effective moment, and this is something that kind of irked me about Superman Returns a little bit, is that he wrenched those lines out of context. I have other problems with that film, but I think the way Brando delivers it again, I think a lot of this is context, because this is Marlon effing Brando, the greatest actor of his generation, doing this comic book movie, and that's unheard of, right? And so what when you bring up the Man of Steel comparison, what I like about both versions is that they are so distinct from each other. I think Zack Snyder was very smart in that he was like, you know what, we're not even going to try to do what they did. This Krypton is totally this other thing, and that allows it to stand on its own. So you can look at both of these and be like, oh, that's that version that I like what they did there, and oh, that's I like some of what they did there, and I think that works. I think the first line of the film is, this is no fantasy. This is no wild product of careless imagination. And what is that? That's Tom Mankiewicz, the writer, telling everyone in the audience, like, hey, this isn't, you know, Batman 66.
You know? Basically, yeah, without Jor-El coming out and saying, hey, we're not going to wink at the camera.
I think that might be the biggest place where I disagree with, I think, both of you on this movie, is that this movie doesn't feel like it takes the material seriously to me. It does feel like a joke. And frankly, probably, and I was kind of joking about my favorite thing about this movie being Virgil Swan, Bridget Crosby, and Dexter. Yeah. Although, I mean, there is some truth to that, because I mean, there's not that much that I do like in this movie. And of course, as a huge Smallville fan, that is a cool thing that is in this movie. But one other thing that I do love and hate about this movie is Lex Luthor and Otis. And I know we're not there yet, but I feel it's important to bring that up right now, though, because to me, that is an example of how this movie doesn't take this seriously. And that's like the most shining example of it. And yet that's the only part of this movie at the same time, even though it goes against my sensibilities for what I want to see out of Lex Luthor, it's also the only part of this movie that really entertains me.
I have issues with them, but I'll save it until Lex and Otis.
I have issues with them too, but it's the only part of this movie that even remotely has me like I did find myself this most recent rewatch of this movie, like, those were the only scenes I got excited for, because I kind of chuckle at a lot of the things Otis does. So it's like, even though it irks me in terms of the portrayal of Lex Luthor, I'm like, yeah, but that's the only part of this movie I really like, though. Yeah,
before we get there, though, I will echo what Zachary was saying about when he does send Baby Kal-El off. I really did like that bit of dialogue and the way Brando delivered it. Then the film moves into Smallville territory. There's a lot I really do enjoy about the Smallville portion of this film. I love, first of all, Glenn Ford and I always mess up her name. Phyllis
Thaxter.
Okay, I was going to say Phyllis Colts. Is it Phyllis Colts that played Lois Lane? I always get them confused. But yeah, Phyllis Thaxter. I thought they were really, really strong as Jonathan and Martha Kent. It's that old school idealism of Americana that I think they really sell. And it's just the whole, when there's the crash, and you know, they find, you know, baby Kal-El. I won't call him Clark until he gets. So we see him as Clark, but when they find him, and you know, you can see where Martha's already taken to the idea of, we're gonna keep this baby, and then Jonathan's like, Martha, we gotta find his proper parents, and we can't keep him, and he's trying to, you know, be realistic about the matter, and she's totally tuned him out, and he's like, Martha, are you listening? Are you even listening to me? And then the baby saves the truck from falling on Jonathan. And the poles where he's holding it up. Correct me if I'm wrong, but is that not in a way? I know it's not the same scene, but is that not a way of sort of paying homage to Action Comics number one with the car? Am I the only one that saw that, or?
No, absolutely.
Okay, so you saw that too.
I didn't think of it, but yeah, now that you bring it up, that's an awesome one.
And then where, you know, when we see Clark in high school, or I guess as a teen, we don't really actually see him in high school, but as a teen in the football, the guy's a jerk to him, and he has that little conversation with Lana before.
And there, right there, is the seed that launched 10 seasons of television, right?
Yeah, it really is.
here's the thing, though.
Small vote became all-time. It's like, I know you're getting excited, but let me preface this. It may lead into your small vote offshoot. I think what happened there is that right then and there, Smallville became an Elseworlds version of Superman the movie, right off of that scene. And that's how I look at Smallville, as an Elseworlds take on the time between, you know, I know it's 12 years in the movie, but the 12 years between Superman being in the Fortress or Clark being in the Fortress and then Smallville. I look at it as an Elseworlds off of that, basically.
You see, if I view it in that lens, it takes away from Smallville to me, because putting it in the context of that, of this other version of Superman that I really don't care for, it almost takes away from the show that I love so much. So I definitely don't want to view it through that lens. But what I was going to bring up was that this scene, first of all, obviously because of Smallville, because of the show Smallville, that's that time in Clark Kent's life is probably my favorite part of the Superman mythology. I love that. I love seeing how this alien from another planet, I love seeing how he, what made him the man he is, what made him the person who grows up and becomes this hero to all of humanity and who becomes Superman. And I think that Smallville does such a great job of course, exploring his journey to becoming that person, what made him that way, the values that Jonathan and Martha instilled in him. Obviously, this movie isn't all about that. Obviously, they only had a small portion of time to deal with that, but they cut that so short. There was so little time here in Smallville, in Superman the movie. And what they did with it is, to me, like, I don't understand how they got it so wrong. Like, there's nothing that draws me in about this scene in Smallville, in this movie.
Which one, the Clark and Lana scene you're talking about?
Yeah, okay. Yeah. There's nothing that draws me in about that. There's nothing that I mean, we don't
because,
actually...
Well, because Jordan, I mean, the Smallville sequence is not an end unto itself, like on the television series, right? I mean, what we're doing with the Krypton sequence and the Smallville sequence is we're laying the pipe, we're putting the pieces in place for the back third of the movie, which is who Clark becomes. So we see on Krypton an indication of who Jor-El is as a person, and then the key pieces of information that we get in Smallville is, number one, he has to keep his powers hidden. Why does he have to? And then the final piece of wisdom that Jonathan gives him, which is, you're here for a reason, and it's not to score touchdowns. And then the final piece of wisdom that Clark himself has to learn is, all those things I can do, all those powers, and I couldn't even save him, right? So in other words, we're not – I mean, it's the goals are different. That's my point, is because Smallville, the series – was about being fulfilling and dramatic on its own as a complete story in and of itself. This is one piece of a story that's meant to pay off, you know, 20-25 minutes down the line. So the goals are different.
I see what you're saying, that they definitely did have different goals. I mean this is just a very small piece of a Superman movie, whereas Smallville was the entire show was showing that journey from of Clark becoming Superman. But I'll even bring up Man of Steel again, in that they gave us a lot more time in Smallville. They got us invested in that aspect of Clark Kent's history, and that they, and that's why in this movie Jonathan Kent's Jonathan Kent's death falls so flat to me, because it's like in Man of Steel and in Smallville, we got so much time. Smallville, it's probably unfair to compare because we did get 5 seasons because it was a TV show. But even in Man of Steel, we got a lot of time with Kevin Costner as Jonathan to get invested in him and to care about him. So when he dies,
I think in many ways, Kevin Costner as Jonathan Kent is for modern audiences. Kevin Costner in that role is for modern audiences what Glenn Ford was for audiences at that time, where to a large extent we know Kevin Costner because of his iconography and we admire him, and he's such a perfect casting as Jonathan. So, yeah. I mean, in the film itself, he's got, what, 1, 2, 3 scenes, right? There's the – I'm trying to think. There's his death scene. There's – when he says, you know, maybe
where he shows him the ship was one of them.
Right. Right. And you are my son. And then,
the one before,
you know, when
with the bus after the bus
right.
rescue. Yeah.
And then when those guys are beating him up and he's like,
yeah,
right. So four. Yeah. Four. Yeah.
And so that's about four scenes. So that's roughly double what Glenn Ford gets. Yeah. But I think I would have loved to spend, you know, 25 more minutes with Kevin Costner as Jonathan Kent. I loved him in that role so much. And again,
there's part a flashback of that too. There's a flashback at the end of the movie too. So he gets a fifth scene.
Okay. So he gets a little, that's not a scene. I mean, that's like a, you know, a snippet of a shot basically. Right. But I mean, I'm not fundamentally arguing with him being very effective in that role, but I think a factor in that is also that we know who Kevin Costner is and we like Kevin Costner. We admire him. And I think Glenn Ford was in 1978 the same way for audiences. So
those,
it's kind of a shorthand.
Yeah.
All right,
it was a shorthand. We're like, oh, Glenn Ford is so good.
Yeah, that's part of the thing of perspective. Now, I will say that I did love, like, in part I agree with Jordan then that I wish, I don't know if I could say I agree with Jordan, but I wish we would have had more scenes with Clark and Jonathan Kent in this movie, because I love what Glenn Ford and Jeff East,
who is dubbed by Christopher
with the voice
Reeve.
Of Christopher Reeve, were doing in those scenes. Like, I really enjoyed their chemistry with each other and the lesson that he's imparting to Clark. And you can see Clark's frustration. With basically saying it's unfair that, you know, these are my natural
is a bird showing off if it flies.
Exactly. I really bought his frustration in those scenes. And yes, the death is abrupt, but I still felt it, you know, emotionally, because what Zaki was saying and what Zaki quoted was that with all his powers, there's no way he could have prevented that.
Even Superman, some things he can't do.
Even though he turned the world around for Lois, and we'll get to that, and I have issues with that. But even though he did that for Lois, he could turn around, even if he knew at that point how to fly and all that, which I presume that he didn't at that point. But even if he did, and he could fly around the world, you can't fix Jonathan Kent's heart issue, right? So,
and that's it's a great concept. I'll give it that. I love that line that Jeffy, or I guess it's really Christopher Reeve that had the line. But
well, Jeffy said the line. It just got you know, dubbed.
Redubbed. Yeah, that's true. Okay.
I'm gonna start a petition. Where's the Jeff East cut of Superman the movie? I want it.
It's a great line, and that's a great idea to play with Clark realizing that he can't see, even with all the powers he has, he can't save his father, and that's great. I just think it could have been executed better if they gave us more time with John.
If you had more time, you would have appreciated it more. I get that.
Yeah,
I get that. But we get that scene, and then he basically, you know, gets the call from the. Here's where I get confused, and it's always rubbed me the wrong way. I've never truly understood it. So maybe I'll get Zaki's perspective. When the green crystal starts, you know, glowing and making all that sound, basically calling to him to go north. I've always wondered, well, why, in terms of the green and the evoking the color of kryptonite, mm-hmm. why is it green, Zaki? Why is it? Shouldn't that? Because I always took that as a kid, and then later on, nobody ever explained anything. Why is that thing green? Why is it? Is that not kryptonite? What is going on there? What's with the?
As far as the specific choice of that color, I don't know why they chose green, but I mean, as far as making it a different color, I think they wanted it to stand out, obviously, as a data crystal as opposed to just the crystals that are, you know, all over Krypton and all over the fortress and stuff. As far as, evoking Krypton, I think that's a valid point. I'm not sure why they made that decision. I can't say that it ever bothered me, but I don't think you're wrong for
it. No, it didn't bother me. It just confused the heck out of me. And still to this day, I'm like, wait a minute. Okay, I get what you're saying. Differentiate.
You expect every time Clark picks it up, you expect his veins to start popping out of his hand.
Like, why isn't he getting sick? I'm confused. But then Bryan Singer just mangled the effects of kryptonite in Superman Returns, so I'm not even going to go there until we have to. So he gets the call from that crystal. He says goodbye to his mother, which, you know, that's a relationship that I also wish we would have got more time with. But at the same token, Man of Steel made up for it, so I'm okay with it. So he gets the call to go north, and he throws the crystal, and we have that. You know, the crystal forms, and again, Smallville did its own rift on this particular scene. And I think Zaki picked the season that happens at the very end. But so in the fortress, now, the fortress forms itself, and he is looking at the console and sort of moving the crystals around, and he comes upon the crystal that has Jor-El's data on it, and we get the holographic, I guess you'd call it, head of Jor-El, and what proceeds is that, so they have the initial conversation of, I'm Jor-El, I'm your father, you're Kal-El, now ask me whatever you want, and it's this, we then travel through you know, space as Marlon Brando is imparting various bits of information and knowledge to Clark/Kal-El. Now, I love the dialogue that Marlon Brando was saying, and I bought it all, and I you know, everything was going great for me in that respect. I just wish we had seen it, like we had seen and I know we get it in the Donner Cut of Part Two, sort of, but I would have loved to have a scene of Marlon Brando and Christopher Reeve, like obviously the holographic, you know, obviously we would be standing there, but the quote-unquote holographic version of Marlon Brando standing there with Christopher Reeve and doing that dialogue. And just instead of going through space, like when he says, and here's Krypton as it was, it would have been cool to see, I think we could have got more of this version of Krypton through those scenes. For budgetary or whatever reasons, they didn't go that route. I just wish they would have. So that was a little bit of a letdown for me. Also, I assumed that during that 12-year lecture, he learned the rest of his powers. Is that fair to assume, guys? I don't know. Zaki, is that?
Yeah, that's a safe bet. I mean, he's when we come back from that montage, he is standing in costume, so he is a fully formed Superman. And I think this is, you know, an area where this movie and Man of Steel diverge, where by the time we see Superman, he is,
Superman,
you know,
he is
in toto, you know. And I think Man of Steel is showing us very much a work in progress character who he's learning as he goes, and you know, it's two different approaches.
I have a feeling that Jordan would have wanted to see more of it, like I did. But
yeah.
But Zaki, where are you with that? Like, would you have preferred to actually see Marlon Brando and Christopher Reeve, you know, across from each other or next to each other? And would you have liked to see Clark learn more of his powers on film as opposed to, you know, off screen?
I mean, it's tricky, you know, because obviously you're dealing with number one, time constraints, and number two, budget constraints. And what the film wanted to do was keep as much of him off camera until his big reveal with the helicopter sequence. So I think what Man of Steel has, which is comparable as far as the big reveal of Superman, is, you know, the first time he takes flight.
Right.
And with this, they wanted to push it further and have it be, you know, when he reveals himself to the world. So I understand the inclination to do that. I as far as Brando being, you know, I don't know, it's tough because obviously the original intent with Superman 2 was to lead up to that moment when Brando sort of steps out of that hologram and is in physical form or whatever. And so had they actually led up to that, it would have made sense. And then they didn't do that, you know, because of the theatrical cut. Right. So yes, we're missing that, but the original intent
was to lead up. Okay, I get what you're saying. Yeah.
You know what I mean? However, that being said, I think, again, as far as little checking boxes that this movie did first, the idea of Jor-El as an artificial intelligence, hey, started with Superman the movie. That's and then true. We saw it again on Smallville. We saw it again in Man of Steel.
That is true. Yeah, got to give it that. But I would have, and the reason why I say it would have been cool to have him on screen with Christopher Reeve, especially the scene where he's like, if it were not for vanity, you know, I could be there to give you a hug. And
right.
That scene was powerful as it was because.
Which is in that's the special edition, but it's not in the theatrical cut. So.
Yeah. Correct. Yeah. And then, but then, you know, Christopher Reeve is extending his hands. It would have been cool.
Right.
At least it would, not cool, but it would have been even more powerful than it was for me, is if he tries to hug the hologram and then he can't. Right. I think that would have just, for me, added a little bit more of a heart wrenching aspect to it than it already had, which it did have, but just, I wish. Mm-hmm. I wish, in certain cases, I wish there was more.
I think that would have made it pretty goofy if he tried to hug a hologram.
I'm not saying he falls over like I'm not saying Trump falling over like a doofus. I'm just saying.
Well, that is probably what he'd do.
No, there's a way to write that. That's not goofy.
I'm saying knowing how clumsy he portrays Clark Kent.
Okay, well, speaking of Clark Kent, let's get nice segue, Jordan.
Well, thank you. Well, hold on. I just wanted to say about that scene. It would have made sense to me if they had saved up for his big reveal. If, and I know this is another place where I'm going to get a lot of pushback.
Why don't you wait till we get there? But why don't you wait till we get to that scene?
Fine. I'll wait till we get to that scene. Okay, but we do get the costume here though, and I can't stand this costume. So can I say that?
Come on.
This costume, I could find a better Superman costume at Party City. Folks, I could find a better.
Send all your hate mail to what's your email address, Jordan?
I could walk into Party City. I have a Party City very close to my house. I could walk over there and get a better Superman costume than this for $50.
Yeah, but you got to take into account the time period we're talking about. We're not talking about 2017. We're talking about 1978.
You're telling me that they could not have made a better Superman costume than that in 1978.
I don't. I think that was the best. I'm assuming they used the best materials. I'm assuming they used everything that was the best available to them. So I'm going to go ahead and say no. I don't think they could have.
Okay. I mean, I guess I'll have to concede that.
What do you think? I given that the thing was for the time quite pricey in terms of budget, I think.
Well, yeah, I mean, this is a time before they were doing things like padded suits and certainly the fabric technology has changed a lot. I mean, the Henry Cavill Superman suit uses screen printing and things like that wasn't available back then. So what did you have? You had Chris Reeve getting put through his paces by David Prowse, Darth Vader was having him work out.
Shout out for you with a Star Wars reference.
I think to a large extent, I give credit to the fact that Christopher Reeve, he wears the suit in a way that he's not self-conscious about it. And I think that makes it go down easier. I mean, I think it's just, you have to contextualize it. You have to look at that as a product of its time, the same way George Reeves in the 50s wore a suit that, you know, with our 2018 perspective kind of looks a little silly, or even Adam West in 1966. But it's like, well, that's what was the approach and the availability of that particular historical moment.
And I'll agree. And look, I'll agree. I look at that suit and I see Superman. Nothing about that bothers me or looks off. Now, I will say, from a personal standpoint, do I prefer what Henry Cavill's wearing? Of course, but
it doesn't even have to be Henry Cavill. A Henry Cavill suit is amazing.
I'm just saying what he's wearing.
Look at Tyler. Even Tyler Hoechlin on Supergirl on a TV budget looks
Right, but again,
it's 10 times better.
2018 versus 1978. It's apples to oranges. That's what I'm telling you. I'm saying, yes, I prefer the modern way of making superhero costumes. However, given what they had to work with, I look at it and I see Superman. So to me, it doesn't.
I mean, even 11 years later, though, in Batman 89, that suit looks significantly better.
Yeah, but again, the materials progressed.
And bear in mind with Batman 80, with Batman as a character, you can put him in molded.
You can put him in armor. It makes sense, yeah.
And it, because he's Batman, I think Chris Reeve didn't have the advantage of being able to do that. And I mean, yeah, let's be honest. I mean, Bob Ringwood, what he did for Batman 89, that was a massive leap forward.
I still love that.
Given what had been done on screen before, I mean, it's like a demarcation line, because we had never seen anything like that before. The Batman 89 suit.
So it still to this day it looks fantastic in my opinion.
It really does.
But
I actually just literally the Hot Toys Batman 89 Michael Keaton figure just arrived at my house, and I've been drooling all over it since yesterday.
Oh god, man, you're making me jealous now. I'm gonna have to Zaki, if I come to your house and steal something, you know.
I'll know who took it.
Take into consideration that I'm just as much a big Batman fan as you are. So,
duly noted.
Don't call the cop. Give me some lead time to run away, then you can call the cop. So Jordan, I'm gonna have to vehemently disagree with you there.
All right.
But getting on to the Metropolis portion,
this is where the movie picks up for me a little bit.
Here's where people may start freaking out at me and sending me hate mail. I can't stand Margot Kidder as Lois Lane.
Yeah, I'm with you.
This iteration of the character. Can somebody explain to me when the conceit that Lois Lane can't spell became? Is this the movie that made it a thing?
That's it. That's
because where it started. She's supposed to be a Pulitzer Prize winning reporter. Now I get it. Not everybody's a proficient speller, but the amount of times that she's corrected or asked, how do you spell this? It's maddening. It literally aggravates. It raises my blood pressure.
Here's the thing though. I'm with you, Adam, to a certain extent, but, and again, this is the thing about this movie, is that I'm so conflicted, because this is where the movie picks up for me, and it's because even though this goes against my sensibility, this is not how I want to see Lois Lane portrayed. This is not how I want to see Lex Luthor portrayed. This is not how I want to see Clark Kent portrayed. But at least I'm laughing. At least I'm entertained. At least I'm not bored out of my mind, almost falling asleep at this part of the movie.
I don't want to laugh at the fact that Lois Lane can't spell.
I know, and nor do I. And that's why I say I'm conflicted. It does aggravate me, because this is not how I want the character to be portrayed. But at the same time, at least I am laughing. At least I am entertained by it. If I look at it with no preconceived notions about what I want to see from Superman, at least if I look at this like just looking at this as a movie, as if she wasn't Lois Lane, as if she was just some other reporter character who isn't Lois Lane, and this isn't a Superman movie, I'm like, yeah, that's a funny scene.
Oh, okay. I didn't laugh at all. I cringed, but it is what it is. And the other thing that really kind of sort of annoyed me was the fact that I didn't see in this particular movie, to the extent that I wanted, that go-getter, tough-as-nails reporter. You know what I'm saying? Like, like we see her writing a story off the top, which she can't spell half the words she's writing. she's being told to go interview the president, which is okay. Then she's doing she's interviewing Superman at his behest. So it's not like she went out and found a way to get him to give her the story. You know what I'm saying? And then, like in the 1986 Man of Steel miniseries origin, and then she's interviewing the guy who sold Lex Luthor the land, right, in the car. But it's not. Like, there's not one scene that gives me the impression of this tough-as-nails, go-getter reporter. And that aggravates me, because, you know, Lois Lane is a pivotal character, you know, when, right there with Superman in the mythology. So I don't think she was handled well at all. Having said that, I really do love Jackie Cooper as Perry White.
Yeah, he's good.
I thought he was good. Fantastic. And Mark McClure, I love him as Jimmy Olsen. I think he's great.
He's good too.
So those two characters I absolutely love. Lois Lane, just the whole time I'm like, I was smacking my head, my forehead. With Clark Kent, this rewatch, I tell you, it changed my mind, because I originally, after my first few rewatches, I thought that Clark Kent was too bumbly and too sort of kind of quote unquote goofy. But I you know, my mind changed on that on this rewatch. I don't think it was as overstated as I originally perceived it. It's a very calculated. There are very calculated moments when Chris Reeve does take it that extra step further, and I think he does it on purpose in those particular scenes. Like he's almost picked his spot of when to go overboard with it. So I've gained an appreciation for it. And then the other aspect that I love about his performance was that it's not overt, but there's a slight slouch between posture as Clark Kent and Superman. I mean, it's not overt at all, so it's not like he's hunching over completely, but it's just a slight dip of the shoulders. And then there's the scene, you know, I'm jumping ahead a bit, where he, you know, in Lois's apartment after they fly, where he comes back as Clark, and then he straightens up, and it's like, oh, wow. And he takes off the glasses, and it's like, all right. Because of that, coupled with the inflection in his voice that changes, I totally bought that Clark Kent and Superman were two different people. So my opinion on that has changed for the better in this rewatch. Zaki, what were your what was your take on the Daily Planet sort of main players and including Chris Reeves, Clark Kent in that?
Well, I agree with you about Margot Kidder as Lois. She's certainly not among my favorites in that role. I think Lois's role in the mythology is really important because she is the reason Clark wants to have a normal life, and she's his link to humanity. And I never bought their connection in this, other than, oh, you know, they're supposed to.
Oh, thank God you said it, because the
yeah, whole... no, I'm that being said, I think Margot Kidder is the of her four times in the role, she is the best in this first one. And if you look at the screen tests for other actresses who were up for the role, and you have like Starford Channing and Leslie Ann Warren, et cetera, et cetera. I mean, she objectively, her screen test is the best of this batch of pretty Ann Archer, you know, these pretty well-known actors at the time. I love Jackie Cooper as Perry White. It's so like very just effortlessly funny in these kind of throwaway moments. I love the thing where he's telling Jimmy, he's like, you know, two creams and no sugar, and don't call me sugar. You know, he's trying to say, don't call me cute. And he has this split second look on his face where he realized what he said. And he's like, you know, and it's this throwaway gag. And I love that. I love the hustle and bustle of the Daily Planet. It feels like all the President's Men or something. There's constantly stuff going on. I really like that.
Yes.
And like you said, Mark McClure's, it feels like a very 1970s newsroom, which I love. I think as far as Chris Reeve's portrayal of, like, I like it, and I like his approach. I think it is very clever in that he's just this side of cartoonish, where he doesn't tip over the line into it being overtly goofy, where you're like, well, nobody acts like that. I think he's very smart about that. That being said, you know, the version of Superman that I grew up with, certainly in the comics, is the John Byrne version, mm-hmm. where he viewed Clark as the real guy and Superman as sort of the suit that he wears. And that's very much beholden to George Reeves.
Yes.
And that's very much represented in Dean Cain. So when I think of my favorite versions of journalist Clark Kent on screen, I think of Dean Cain and George Reeves.
See, Zachary, I think we were separated by years in birth and also parentage, but because we have the exact same philosophy on the Clark Kent aspect. And also, I will point out, Jordan, just before I interrupt you, Zach, sorry to interrupt you.
Yep.
Jordan, if the moment where Tom Welling actually gets to play the Clark Kent persona, it's very George Reeves inspired.
And Chris Reeve.
Yeah, but very. But there's a lot of. I don't want to get too much into this moment because Jordan's going to get overly excited. But the one scene that I'm thinking about is, remember the scene? I think it was the 200th episode with Brainiac when he goes into the future in the elevator.
Yeah, Homecoming.
Yeah, and he sees the future version of himself.
Yeah.
That was pure George Reeves that Welling was channeling. And I'm like, in this instance, I love Tom Welling. I actually said that on screen when I watched it. So you're right. There is a bit of Chris Reeve, especially in the finale in Tom Welling.
Right. That's what I was thinking of, yeah. You know, let me just add, and I think – this is one of those things where we say the advantage of having a character who has such a long history and so many different versions is that with each subsequent version, you can look at the one before and be like, oh, I like what that one did, or maybe that one didn't, that thing didn't work as much, you know, and you can make adjustments on the fly because that, you know, it's a constantly evolving thing. I think what we've seen in recent iterations of Superman on screen, specifically with Smallville and Man of Steel and the DCEU is to make Lois a partner in the sort of creation of the Superman identity from the jump. And I think that ties her in much more closely and it makes her that much more valuable to the totality of Clark. And you know, it removes us from the way the character was envisioned originally, which is, you know, these two dorky guys, Jerry Siegel and Joel Schuster, who are like, oh, you know, that hot girl, She likes the jock. She doesn't like me, but man, if she knew what I was really like, oh man, she'd love me, right? That was right. I mean that and you see that certainly reflected. You see that in the old TV show, in the Reeve films, and even to a lesser extent in Lois and Clark. And I like that times have evolved to say, well, the female lead is not just like the object of desire. She's vital and valid and valuable.
But also I like the fact that you know. And that was one of my issues with the Lois Lane portrayal here, and also in Superman Returns, and you know is that Lois doesn't give Clark another thought. It's just Superman comes on the scene and she turns into like, you know, a 14-year-old at a Justin Bieber concert where she's all Gaga, and it's like, hello, like, you know, I feel so bad for Clark Kent because I get that he's also Superman, but in some cases. And specifically Superman Returns, she treats him like shit. You know, there's no beating around the bush there. And so it's like I'm agreeing with Zaki where I much prefer where Lois is in on it, and then she actually appreciates Clark Kent. I hesitate to say the quote unquote real Clark Kent, but you guys know what I mean by that.
Yeah.
Let's get to the, because I know Jordan has issues with it, and I think. Zachy and I are going to agree on this next point, and then Jordan's going to be off in a bizarre world.
Hold on. I didn't think we were done talking about the last part.
Okay, tell me about your take on Chris Reeves, Clark Kent, and all.
Yeah, because for me it's like nobody would put up with that. Nobody would put up with a guy walking around completely overly bumping into people, and it's like it completely feels out of place because, like – To me, it's like this is one of the places where the movie goes overboard with the silliness and I can't take it seriously. So to me, this is another example of, I know Zachy said it earlier, and this is where I disagree that Richard Donner took this stuff seriously. I'm like, this is like a slapstick comedy. That being said, the performance Christopher Reeve gives, if this were a comedy, is phenomenal. He really does a great job with that. I mean, he's great switching into that, you know, bumbling persona, and I on that hand I love it, and it does crack me up several times what he's doing, but at the same time it's like, that's not how I want Clark Kent portrayed, and it just completely I can't take anything seriously when this guy is going around bumping into every single person he walks in, he walks into, and it's like people would not put up with that in a workplace. I mean, the fact that people are as okay with it as they are, it's absurd. And it's like it's like it's from a completely different movie, or at least, I mean, that's the thing though. This whole movie, I find so many things in it that I'm like, that is just too silly, and I can't take it seriously. But it's like, I don't know what they were thinking with that. I really don't.
Well, I mean, I was initially in your camp a while back, but then when I rewatched it, sure, he bumps into people a couple of times, but I don't think it was as overt as
it isn't. And I think as far as what they were thinking, Jordan, I mean, here's ultimately what the filmmakers in 78 had to figure out, which is Superman's secret identity is inherently absurd if you spend too much time thinking about it. The idea that I mean, it just is, and I say this as the biggest Superman fan on the planet, but the idea that Clark Kent takes off his glasses and nobody knows who he is preposterous, right? So I think what they arrived at, and I give most of the credit on this to Christopher Reeve, is Clark couldn't just be a pair of glasses. Clark had to be a character who it wouldn't even occur to you that he could be anything but this person.
Yeah.
Right. And so what we see, certainly, I think the most bumbling of Clark we get is in his introduction scene, like Daily Planet Clark's introduction scene in, you know, where he's, you know, the thing with the soda where he opens a bottle and whatever. And it's really out there right on Front Street. Right. And I think if you're going inside Clark's head, that's by design. To really look meek and unassuming, right? Now, as far as why people tolerate it, well, Perry White says it, right? Yeah, he might be mild man or whatever, but he's got a snappy, punchy pro style. In other words, he's got the goods, too, as a writer.
That line, though, that it does always crack me up. I'll give it that. The line where he says something when he spills the soda, he's like, why would you want to embarrass a total? Of course it was a mistake. Why would you want to embarrass a total stranger?
Yeah, it was great. Like, so many of his performance, it is so iconic for a reason, and I love that.
You know, Christopher Reeve had the great line in an interview where he said, either Lois is an idiot or Clark is a good actor.
And I choose the latter.
Yeah, he's like, I don't want Lois to be an idiot. So, you know, I think that it's Tarantino. In Kill Bill, it was like, oh, Clark Kent is like Superman making fun of people. It's like, no, I don't think that. I think Clark Kent is Superman's, that's his comfortable place. That's where he gets to escape to.
Yeah, I look at it as him putting on a performance.
Yeah.
Well, the thing to do to avoid Lois looking like an idiot is do what Man of Steel did and have her figure out who he is.
Yeah, right, but that wasn't the conceit.
But Jordan, again, that you're talking with the benefit of
hindsight.
And bear in mind, by the time Man of Steel came out, Lois had known who Superman was. I mean, they were married, and for almost 20 years they had been, or 15 years at that point, it was a shared secret. But when Superman the movie came out, the idea of Lois Lane figuring out and forever knowing his identity was just, that wasn't on the table.
And especially, I'm sure if they went to DC and said, hey, can we make her, they're like, are you crazy? So I'm sure there must have been some push. Even if somebody over there, you know, Richard Donner or Mankiewicz or the Saul Kinds or whoever said, why don't we do this? I'm sure they had to – something that big they would have had to clear by DC Comics. And I can pretty much guarantee you that DC at the time would have said, are you
– that would have been a non-starter back then. Yeah, no question.
Like, no way. And so I get –
Oh, so DC was meddling with their filmmakers all the way back?
No, I don't think so, but because I don't think anybody had the foresight to say, why don't we
– I highly doubt that Richard Donner and Tom Mankiewicz even would have considered that as an option, because that just wasn't what you did. You know, I mean,
to them it would have been going against the canon, and for him, it was all about preserving the core, you know, mythology up to that point of Superman. Is that fair to say? You guys still there?
I mean,
we're still here.
I'm processing it.
Oh, okay. I wowed you all with that. I thought, wow, that was really smart. but yeah, no, so I don't think that it was, like Zaki said, I don't think Donner was in a place where he's like, I'm not going to mess with the mythology at all.
And by the way, Richard Donner didn't need DC to get in his way. He had his own producers cockblock him from the sequel.
People think that that Mustachegate 2017 is an issue. Donner had it worse.
That's true.
So going to now the big Superman moment, if you will, the rescue, the helicopter rescue. I love it. It's been, you know, this scene has been repurposed or paid homage to is a better word, in Birthright, in Smallville did its own version. I'm trying to think, there's another place that I saw it. It could have been the animated series. I'm not sure. But the helicopter. Oh, no. Secret
Origin.
Secret Origin, yeah. So in those books, they've all repurposed the helicopter rescue to suit their own.
And Man of Steel, the comic book Man of Steel, via Lois Lane being on a space plane is an evocation of that.
Sure, yes, yeah. But I think it's an iconic rescue. You get everything. You get a nod to Superman's days of changing in a phone booth. You get the iconic shirt rip scene. The guy saying, well, it's a bad outfit, I could have done without. That's pure 70s kind of stuff. But I could have done without that. But then I look at it from as a technical marvel as well, because to do that in 1978 and make it look, for me personally, that good, is astonishing. It really is. And then when Superman, you know, when Christopher Reeve says, don't worry, miss, I've got you. And then she's like, you've got me. Who's got you? And then, so there's that scene. And then the scene at the end where she's like, who are you? And he turns to her and he looks her straight in the eye and says, I'm a friend. He says both of those lines of dialogue with such honesty and conviction. Anybody else, coming out of anybody else's mouth that they had in mind for Superman at the time, you would have laughed your ass off had somebody else said that. But with him, there was just such honesty and like, yeah, okay, I buy it. And so I just love the whole scene. Zachy, what's your take on Superman's big reveal?
No, it's terrific. I mean, the whole sequence is really effective, not only because of the effects, not only because of Christopher Reeve's performance, but also the way John Williams' score, we haven't talked about at all, but I mean, it's almost like a co-lead, you know, John Williams and Superman theme. And all of that works together to really make us, I mean, he steps out of that revolving door in his costume, and Jordan may disagree, but I mean, I you know, certainly for me, even now, I don't find it funny. I'm like, that's Superman, you know? And I think there is just something really magical about that. That being said, I think a major flaw in this sequence, which I didn't really even think about until recently, is that the helicopter crashes on top of the Daily Planet. And then this whole pandemonium starts. Here's Lois Lane hanging from the thing. And then cut to Clark Kent walking out of the building. And he's like, hey, what's all the panic? And then he looks up and he's like, holy crap. And then he, you know, and I'm like, wait a minute. Clark Kent was like five floors down from where this happened. So you're telling me Superman, with his super hearing, didn't hear the helicopter like 20 feet up, you know?
That is a great point.
Damn it, I never noticed that. Zachy, you found a flaw in the scene that I didn't want to have a flaw.
Right? Like, it takes him like, hey, what's everybody pointing out? Whoa! You know, like, wait a minute, you're Superman. What are you doing?
He's like, damn it, I better do something. Why didn't my hearing kick in?
Yeah, exactly.
Maybe there was super wax. The Q-tip didn't get all.
But it still works for me. That is a plot hole, in my opinion.
Oh, definitely. But there, you know, there are some that, because I guess for me and you, and most of the known world, the scene works so well that you can overlook. And now we come to Bizarro Man.
The exception.
All right. What's your take on the scene? Go ahead.
Okay, I don't. This scene is not.
I can't save you from the hate mail, by the way. It's you.
I know. I have a feeling I might get a lot of it after this episode. This scene is not. I don't think the scene is bad. It's just it does nothing for me. It does nothing for me. And it's like you were talking about, I can't remember which one of you guys was talking about earlier, how they were trying to save up Superman's big reveal for this scene. And I'm like, that's actually a pretty good idea if this scene had been anything special. And to me, this scene is, and I understand maybe it was technologically very back in 1978 that like it was an impressive feat that they pulled off the Superman flying up and rescuing the helicopter and all that. I understand that. And I'm like, okay, that's cool. And that's cool that they pulled it off. But, okay, so the scene starts off with this comedic thing where Superman first can't find a full phone booth to change in. And he sees the small little phone booth thing, and then he's like, oh, I can't change in there. And then he has to go to spin around in the door or whatever he does. And I'm just like, oh, okay, so at first you're supposed to – they play that off for laughs. And then they have the guy, the bad outfit guy,
yeah.
Who's just really – I mean, I'm like, come on. This is supposed to be Superman trying to return. You have to throw a joke in there. And then it's like – He, or not his return, but his triumphant entrance, I should say. And it's like, and again, I got to compare it to Man of Steel because that's, I mean, that's the other Superman origin movie we have to compare this to. And it's like, to me, that is, and I've said before how much I love Superman's first flight in Man of Steel, his entrance in that movie.
Well, I'm
and
not
it's like,
argue with you there.
It's one of the greatest film scenes ever. And it's Superman, and you've got the, and again, I like the Hans Zimmer Superman score way more than I like John Williams' score, and you get the.
I love both.
I don't dislike John Williams' theme. I like it, of course, but it doesn't have nearly the same emotional resonance with me that the Hans Zimmer theme has. And you get that, and you have Superman flying off, and you see, and you have the words from Jor-El in the background. Of him talking about the world racing behind Superman, and you have Superman flying, and you see him, the joy of him. This is not a Man of Steel podcast. Now I'm going off on Man of Steel.
Yeah, we did that earlier.
Yeah, no, and I talked about how much I loved him on that show. But he's smiling.
But even that, Jordan. I mean, again, just to go back to what I was saying earlier, each version is able to pick and choose from stuff that came before. So that whole speech. I mean, that's Grant Morrison. That's All-Star Superman, right? So Zack Snyder and David Goyer had that in their toolbox to now pull from and add resonance, and that wasn't something that was part of the canon, you know.
Okay, that's true. But even beyond that speech, though, the music and Superman, the joy in Superman's face and seeing him and seeing this huge triumphant – like, the thing – that scene brings tears to my eyes every time I watch it. This is just like, I don't dislike this scene by any means as helicopter rescue, but it's just like, okay.
You're saying it doesn't have the same emotional resonance for you.
It doesn't have any emotional resonance for me. No, it's just, okay, he saved a helicopter. And it's like,
it's the first time you see Superman save anything. How can you not?
And again, I'll go back to it. He looks like a guy in bad cosplay in this movie.
God.
So I just... I mean, I'm sorry. I know that, and Zachy, I'll take your word for it that they couldn't have had a better costume at the time. But still, watching it in 2018, that takes me out of this movie. And it's like,
yeah, no, but you're not wrong, Jordan, for feeling that way. Just to be very clear, yeah. I mean, it's the same reason. Like, I appreciate the George Reeves TV show, but I mean, that I don't have any kinship with that show above and beyond its sort of place in Superman history. You know, we imprint on our version.
Yeah. Like here's my, and just cause you brought it up, Zachy, I enjoy the George Reeves series, as a Superman, you know, show and as a piece of Superman history. But you know,
yes.
If I had a choice of what I'm going to pop in first, you know, if I'm sitting around saying I need a Superman fix, what am I going to watch today? My go-to is, well, I'll be honest with you, first thing I might pop in is the animated series because,
sure.
You know, aside from Lois and Clark, that was the first non-comic book representation of Superman. You know, so that's what I'd pop in. But I get what you're saying, Jordan. Again, you're not wrong. It's just I think Zachy and I have a better way or a better understanding of how to watch something with the time it was released in mind. Whereas you literally
right.
watch it in, I'm in 2018, so I'm going to watch it with all of 2018's technology and storylines and everything available.
It's harder. I guess that is a good point. And I mean, I think it's harder for me to separate it as, okay, well, this came out in 1966. This came out in 1978. And I bring it up 66 because I have the same problem with the 60s Batman series. And it's because, I can't... I'm looking through it in 2018 lens, and even when I'm trying to tell myself, okay, but this came out 40 years ago, I'm in this place where I'm like, well, yeah, I get that, but it doesn't help me view it any less. It doesn't help me be able to take it any more seriously, I can't put myself in those shoes. And maybe it's because I'm younger, that could be part of it. But at the same time, I'm like, it doesn't work for me. And I mean, this scene, again, it's not, I don't think it's a bad scene. It doesn't do anything emotionally for me. It doesn't evoke any emotions for me. Like, and so I don't get the same. People talk about this is Superman's triumphant entrance in this movie, and it's one of the best comic book movie scenes ever. And to me, I'm like, it's just a super. I mean, it's not bad, but I'm like, it's.
Yeah, and I mean, if it doesn't do anything for you, there's nothing we can do or say to change your mind. That's fine. And you're entitled to your opinion, of course. But I think now we got to go. Here's where I have the most problem with the movie. And it's all the, basically, everything Lex Luthor. Okay, well, I shouldn't say that. His plan is very devious, and it's very, he's very menacing, and it's very, like, he kills, he's willing and has no trepidation of killing people. That's clear. His plan is thought out, and it's conceived to a degree that you'd expect from a Lex Luthor, someone with Lex Luthor's mind. Having said that, the land obsessed Lex Luthor, I call him the real estate Lex Luthor. I don't like it. I don't like the fact that someone of that intellect that can come up with a plan of that magnitude, it can surround himself with such morons. why would you and he even calls Otis a nincompoop, Neanderthal, he rolls through,
it's so funny to me that this is your biggest issue with this movie, and like, for me, it's the only time in the movie when I'm entertained.
Yeah, because I love, like, the plan. I'm like, all right, I'm with it. I get it. And because it's the first time they went with the whole real estate angle, I was all right with it. Then when Superman Returns regurgitated it, it frustrated me to no end. But this version of Lex, it's not. I don't know. It doesn't. It's aggravating. It's frustrating on so many levels, because making Superman have to, essentially choose, which portion of to save. Like, who's he gonna save? Because the rockets are going in two different, or the missiles are going in opposite directions. So what's he gonna do? That whole aspect of it is great, and the scenes revolving around that big rescue, I think, even though, Zach and I love the first save, the whole him chasing and stopping those rockets and repairing the damage afterwards before the fly around the world, I thought were awesome visuals and great, Superman moments. But the fact that it's tied to this iteration of Lex and Miss Tessmacher and that moronic Otis, it frustrates me to no end. It really did, because Gene Hackman's a fantastic actor, and when he is, there's certain bits of dialogue of his with Superman that I love, and then there's moments where he goes with the comedy, and I can't do it. Zaki, what's your take on the whole? Talk about Lex, the fact that he surrounds himself with morons, and then also his plot in general, and what you thought of all that.
Well, it's interesting. I think you can see where there's a little bit of the influence of the Batman 60s show, where they would get these big name actors to kind of come in and sort of ham it up, and each week or each every 2 weeks would be like a showcase for this guest actor, and to an extent Gene Hackman's Lex feels a little bit like that. He's a lot of fun to watch. I don't disagree about Miss Tessmacher and Otis being so sort of aggressively stupid, or at least Otis certainly being aggressively stupid. That other than the fact that he is completely, you know, beholden to Luthor, like there's not a lot of reason for him to keep him around.
Yeah.
But you know, the interesting thing about Lex Luthor is, I mean, on screen we've had, you know. I mean, okay, obviously there's Lyle Talbot back in like Adam Man vs. Superman, but like in terms of the iconic live action versions, we've got Gene Hackman, you got Sherman Howard on Superboy, you've got John Shea, Michael Rosenbaum obviously, and what's his name, Jesse Eisenberg. And I mean, say what you want about each of those, about whether you like one better than the other, whatever, but those are five completely distinctive takes on Lex Luthor. I mean, sure. They are completely separate. Like, it's you know what I mean? Like, I think that's what's interesting about Lex Luthor. It's different from, like, the Joker, for example, where whether you're talking about Heath Ledger or Cesar Romero or whatever, they've all got certain characteristics that you're like, yeah, that's the Joker.
Yeah.
But you're not going to confuse Gene Hackman's Lex with John Shea's Lex. You're not going to confuse Rosenbaum's Lex with Eisenberg's. You know, they're so different. And I think that's cool. I think I like that this character allows for these vastly different portrayals that all have something interesting about them. And I think what Hackman's doing is, I mean, when you look at who was Lex in the comics at the time, right? He wasn't even wearing the power armor. He was wearing like the purple shirt with the green pants, like what he was wearing on Super Friends at the time.
Yeah.
Like you couldn't have that in the movie. So I think they found this version that sort of fit within the milieu that they created. I can roll with it just because I think Hackman is so much fun to watch. I mean, Popeye Doyle. You know what I mean? He's playing it to the hilt, but I think he's fun. But I do think here's the trick. I think like one of his great lines is where you know when Superman first shows up and he's like Superman's like, is that how you get your kicks, by planning the death of innocent people? And he's just so coldly, he's like, no. By causing the deaths of innocent people. And you're like, ooh.
Yeah, no,
I love that.
There are moments, and that's why his performance is not what I have a problem with.
I don't disagree with you. I mean, I think that it's very over the top, and it's kind of like, I guess you just got to roll with it. That's how I am with it. But you're not wrong. I mean, I don't disagree with that.
Fair enough. I'm down with that. And what I did like about when he is, you know, trying to repair the damage from what Luthor did, is that they checked all the boxes. Like, you know, he could reverse the course of mighty rivers. Like, they checked that box.
Right.
You know, and so they went through every classic, you know, descriptor of Superman, and they checked every single box. And it was great. And also, I noticed this in hindsight, obviously, but when he saves the bus on the bridge, I think Zack Snyder was doing a kind of like a sort of clever,
yeah, absolutely,
callback, homage to that, and
I totally agree.
Young Justice did an homage to that too.
Yes, yeah. And even I think you guys mentioned it on the Batman on Film show, and we forgot to mention it here, where Clark is heading to the fortress, and you know the hitchhiking scene. I think Zack Snyder made a parallel as well to that.
Yes, that's right. I think Rick mentioned that. Yeah.
So there are some as well. So that was everything around that plot, like Superman having to repair the damage and make those rescues and make those choices, I loved. It was just balancing the cold and just the, like, mass murder that Lex was willing and happy to perform with the over-the-top Batman 66-esque, little bit of performance. It was hard for me to balance the two. That was where my problem came in. And then I'll get to this, and then I'll let Jordan give his thoughts and whatever Zachy wants to comment with. The spinning the world backwards, I understand that was originally the ending of 2, but because of all the on-set shenanigans and chaos, they had to put that into 1. But that aspect of it bothers me for the simple fact that Jor-El said you cannot interfere in human history, and he Clark himself said, with all my powers, there are certain things I can't prevent. And then what do? They have him, you know, essentially reverse time by spinning the world to save Lois Lane. And just, it's like, okay, but you guys are kind of contradicting yourselves.
I don't think the film is as clear as it could be, but what we see in that moment, remember, he flies up into the clouds, and on the one hand, we hear Jor-El saying, it's forbidden for you to interfere in human history. And then we hear Jonathan saying, one thing I do know, you are here for a reason. So it's this moment where Superman is choosing humanity. He's choosing his human father. Yeah, he's saying, and I agree that first of all, I think the device, the time travel device or whatever the hell it is, it's not clear and it's silly. And I'm not going to defend it because I think.
Okay, so you're in agreement there with me at least. Okay, good.
Yeah, I am. I don't like it in this movie. I don't like it at the end of the Richard Donner edit of Superman 2. I don't like that. Because I'm like, how many mulligans does Superman give himself now? He's like, oh, that didn't go well. Here, let me just go back in time real fast. Let me turn back the Earth again, you know? And I'm like, if you're turning back the Earth, does that do anything to the tides and to like the orbit of the Earth is not just your plaything, you know? So
yeah.
I'm not going to defend it. However, that moment, I do feel like we got two really valuable things there. Is I think the way Chris Reeve plays his response to Lois's death is extremely powerful. And the way he slowly builds up, you just see the rage building up in him. And we haven't seen that the entire movie. We haven't seen him lose his cool. And the way he screams as he flies to the heavens, I think it's fantastic.
I give it that for sure. The emotional resonance.
And I almost feel like, to me at least, I'm like, I'm willing to look past the utter comical, in a bad sense, absurdity of the whole turning back the Earth thing, because I do feel like the lead up to it at least does land a little bit of a punch, you know?
I definitely agree with you there, for sure. It's just the idea that this is what you have, Superman, like, you know, it just the whole idea is like, I can't. Because what exactly? I'm thinking, okay, what are the ramifications of you doing this, though? Like, my mind goes there, like what you said. Like, how does this just become your plaything?
What are the physics of this?
Yeah. So you can just say, okay, I'm going to do this. So, yeah, that you can just do this and sort of, okay, and there's nothing, there's no consequences.
Right.
You could theoretically do that for every movie. Whatever, if something happens that he doesn't like, all right.
Yeah, exactly.
Can we do that for Superman 4 and Superman Returns? Because I'd love to do that.
Well, he did. That's why those were wiped out of the canon.
And furthermore, can we have him do that for Batman Forever and Batman and Robin? Because I'm down for that.
You don't want to give me – Superman Returns is a 10 times better movie than this movie, in my opinion.
We'll get there when we get there. What are your thoughts on – we know you liked Lex Luthor, or you laughed at Lex Luthor.
Yeah.
But what are your thoughts on the finale and all this?
Okay, hold on. I got to talk about Lex Luthor and Otis, because that's the only part of this movie I actually really enjoy. It's like I was saying, it's really funny because I'm complete opposite of you. I couldn't care less about anything else.
Yeah, you're bizarro. What can I tell you?
I couldn't care less about anything else that's going on at the end of this movie. I couldn't care less about the Superman action with him saving all these people and all. If I could get an entire movie, if the entire 3 hours of this movie was just Lex Luthor and Otis bantering back and forth, I would like this movie so much better. Okay, is this the version of Lex Luthor I want to see? No, absolutely not. But is he, frankly, my second favorite live-action Luthor after Rosenbaum? Yes. Now, is he way far away from Rosenbaum in terms of that list? Yes. It's not even close. But in terms of all the others, he's my favorite because he cracks me up. And he and Otis is my favorite character in this entire movie.
For probably. God's sakes.
I'm sorry, and here's where I think there's a difference. You guys are able to take other things in this movie seriously. I'm not. I don't take any of this movie seriously. So to have this completely ridiculous comic slapstick aspect to this movie, it doesn't detract from the rest of the movie to me because I can't take the rest of it seriously. At least this part cracks me up. Like Otis bringing his robe into the pool and Lex getting mad at him. I've literally got a list of Luthor. I'm looking at the quotes page on IMDb, all these Luthor quotes. Like when Lex asks him to take Superman's cape and he goes, I don't think he wants me to, Mr. Luthor.
No, don't get me wrong. That was a good impression, by the way. Well done.
Thank you.
No, I don't get me wrong. I laughed at those scenes. It's just that I could do without that. I wish Lex wouldn't surround himself with, to put it his way, Neanderthals.
Well, we know why he keeps Miss Tessmacher around. I mean, like,
I was trying to find a way to work that in, but yeah, okay, Miss Tessmacher, I'll excuse
Miss Tessmacher. I can think of two very compelling reasons he keeps her around.
Yeah, I agree with that. And to be fair, she did show some, you know, intelligence that she had the wherewithal to say no. She did it for personal reasons for her mother.
Well, her mother lives in Hackensack.
But, but she had a redemptive something that I could appreciate aside from.
By the way, real quick, I that's another great Lex moment where she's like, Lex, my mother lives in Hackensack, and he just kind of looks at his watch and he just shakes his head.
Yeah, and I'm like,
yeah, oh, I love that.
In my head,
that.
I'm like, what a jackass! No compassion.
You see this. Everything with Lex in this movie just it cracks me up. Like he asked Otis, I just keep looking down these lines. I keep scrolling through all these quotes from the movie on IMDb. When Lex asks Otis, is that the newspaper I asked you to get me? And Otis says, yeah. And he's like, why am I not reading it?
Reading
and,
it? Yeah.
Okay, because I haven't given it to you yet.
I don't know. Yeah, like I said, the lines are hilarious. Like I got no problem with the dialogue.
And Gene Hackman makes a meal out of it, man. You can tell he's just having a blast.
And the thing that it is, like, you can tell his, you can see the intellect in his Lex Luthor because of the sheer frustration he has every time Otis opens his mouth. It's just like, why am I, like, even he's acknowledging, why am I with these idiots? Like, you know what I'm saying? So
yeah.
There is an element of that I appreciate. But aside from the fact that you love, you know, the banter between the two of them, what did you think of the finale and, you know, the chasing the rockets and turning back time and all that jazz. What did you?
It bored the hell out of me, quite honestly.
even the chasing the rockets.
Yeah, yeah.
One odd bird, you know.
The entirety of this movie, literally, because we were just talking about it. The entirety of this movie, I wish it was just Lex Luthor and Otis, and I'd be happy. It every time it cuts away from them is when I get bored, and it's like the whole thing at the end, and you know how I feel about Resurrections, so don't even get me started about the whole spinning the world back to save Lois. I think that was awful. I mean, other than the fact that we have Smallville actors in this movie, the only thing I like about this movie is Lex Luthor and Otis, and that's the only thing that saves I'm not just okay about. I really, really like the Lex Luthor and Otis stuff. Like when I'm looking at another quote here, when Lex is putting, he has the map of what he's gonna do with the West Coast, and he's reading down the
Otisburg,
Lexington, Marina del Lex, Otisburg, and he's like Otisburg.
I gotta give it credit. It was funny.
It's so funny. Okay, I'll wipe it off. Just a little.
It's just a little bitty place.
I'm not saying it wasn't funny. So that's the part of the third act that you liked was Otis and Lex. That was your takeaway.
Oh yeah. That's my takeaway from this whole movie. Even if I'm bored out of my mind for the rest of this movie, at least there's Otis and Lex. Watching this movie just this week in preparation, the 3 hours, and I was like, oh god, can this please be over? But every time the Otis and Lex scenes would come on, I'd be very happy, and I kept waiting for the next one, and I was always very.
And I will say that I did love the flyaway ending where he kind of comes towards the camera and smiles. I will always be a sucker for that. To me.
And I like that Man of Steel paid subtle homage to that with the similar shot. Not so much the waving at the camera, but like the
after his first flight when he comes.
That's right.
Yeah. As opposed to Superman Returns, which just plagiarized.
It appropriated cultural appropriation.
Yeah, I call it plagiarism. Bryan Singer can excuse it whatever way he wants. I call it plagiarism. But anyway, all right. So we've come to the end of this. We've pretty much covered all the aspects of the film. Before we give our grade, is there anything else either of you want to specify that we may have missed?
This is not something we missed necessarily, but I mean, Jordan has mentioned the 3-hour edit, and as someone who adores this movie, I want to encourage people to not watch the 3-hour edit of the movie.
Oh wow!
Especially if you haven't seen it.
I haven't, so don't watch it.
I would say if you have not seen it, if you're a fan, it's a curiosity.
Okay.
But it's just the movie you want to watch is the theatrical cut, because the this 3-hour monstrosity is just it doesn't add nuance or texture or even new scenes. It's just little headers and footers that pad it out. So it feels every inch of its running time, and I don't think it ends up being a substantially more fulfilling experience. You know what I mean? I think.
So it's not like BVS where the extended
cut no.
made the movie better.
No, I mean BVS, it's like the difference between a letter grade.
Yeah. Okay. Fair. Yeah. It's, yeah. Okay.
You know.
I see.
Like or dislike BVS, the ultimate cut is an improvement on.
It's the only cut I watch, Jackie.
Yeah.
After the theater experience.
This is not that. I think the best version, even better than Donner's special edition, to be honest, I think the theatrical cut is the best version of the movie.
All right. Thank you for that. You got a warning. So if you haven't purchased it's
a PSA, in my opinion.
There you go. Zaki's here to save our listeners some money if they haven't spent it already. And the thing is, the reason why I didn't purchase it because on Amazon, I can't get it through the Canadian Amazon.
Oh, I see.
And it's like $21 because you get the extended edition, which I have, plus this 3-hour cut. And it's $21 by the time you convert it to Canadian dollars, plus shipping, I'd be spending like $50 on this thing. I'm like,
it ain't worth the 20, much less the 50.
Yeah, I'm like, it's not gonna.
It's ironic that I'm the person here who doesn't care for this movie very much, and I'm the one who watch the
3-hour
cut.
As a side note, I'm kind of glad because I provided you some torture, and that's for having to make me watch Batman and Robin again, so there you go.
We haven't done that yet.
No, but the knowledge that I have to makes me a little bit more nauseous every day. But with that PSA from Zaki in the can, it's time to do our grading of this movie. Jordan, since you are going to have the lowest grade, I think we'll go to you first. What is your grade of this film?
The Lex and Otis stuff is like an A-.
All right, sure. And then the film as a whole?
But, well, that's the thing. I'm trying to average it out. Everything else is like a C-, I would say.
Right.
So I'm trying to think where this really places because, I mean...
So C, C+, where are we going here?
I don't know. I'm tempted because, like, do I really want to sit through the rest of this movie just to watch Lex and Otis? Is there a cut? Can somebody make a cut that's just all the Lex and Otis scenes that I can watch?
Yeah, really. You'll get that along with the Snyder cut of Justice League. They'll come in a two-for-one combo. It'd be great. Yeah.
Hey, well, this is something that anybody could sit and go on a video editor and just clip them together.
If you can find somebody to do that just for you, then good for you. You found a true friend. But what is your actual grade of the whole thing?
This one's so hard for me because, like, I really don't like this movie very much at all. But then again, there is the Lex and Otis stuff that I like a lot. So, C? Can I give it a C?
You can give it
right
you want.
In the middle.
It's your grade. You can give it whatever you want.
Cause I'm trying to think what feels right. Is this C minus? Yeah, because it's got to be higher than a C-.
You're very torn on this. This I can tell it's causing you a lot of strife here.
It is. It really is. Cause like I really don't like it that much at all. But there's this one aspect of the movie that I like a lot, and it's like, okay, I'll give it a C, just right smack in the middle of C.
All right, fair enough. Zaki, as somebody who loves this actor's as Superman and this movie, what is your overall grade?
Oh, it's a very solid A for me. And yeah, as I mentioned, I mean, I just adore this movie. I can watch it all the live long day. But I hope what has been clear just in our conversation is I adore the character of Superman. I love every depiction of him, I can find something to enjoy and appreciate. And I love how the Lois and Clark version has something special and distinct. I love that the current DCEU version is special and distinct. And they all feed off of and grow off of, and they just build this myth of the greatest piece of American mythology that was created in the 20th century, in my opinion.
I'm glad you said that because to me the character it's like a it's a tapestry, right? And each
exactly right.
Each piece is like a new addition of fabric or a new piece of fabric that you just add on and it grows and there's an entry point to this character for everybody, and I can look at this stuff and appreciate, like, you know, The Adventures of Superman, for example, the George Reeves show. My mom grew up as a kid watching that. So for me, having those DVDs and be able to revisit that with her, it's a cool and special thing.
And I should say real quick, I respect this movie because I realize that we wouldn't have the current superhero movie landscape that we have today without it. And a lot of my favorite superhero movies wouldn't exist without this movie, very likely. So I'll always respect for that, even if I don't like this movie very much on its own merits.
Yeah. And so what my grade is this. I give it a B+. I you know, there's a lot to love. Sure, there's things that I wish they had done differently, and there's things that I flat out don't like. But at the end of the day, you know, Christopher Reeve gives such a magnificent performance as the character. It lives up to its tagline of "You will believe a man can fly," and the fact that I can personally pop it in at any moment and not bat an eye at the visuals of him flying and say, "Wow, that doesn't look very good." You know, the fact that I can still look at it and buy into that, yeah, there's Superman flying and he's saving Air Force One or whatever he's doing, you know, and the music, like, you know, we haven't stressed it enough. I love what John Williams did. That doesn't take away from what Hans Zimmer did, because I love that too. I'm not going to sit on the internet and get into a fight about, oh, wow, this music is this. I love it all. To me, when I need inspiration or motivation, guess what's on my list of things? For 1 hour when I'm writing, I'll listen to John Williams. If something takes me 2 hours to write, second hour, I'll listen to Hans Zimmer, because to me, I love it all. And I appreciate, I can find something even in Superman 4, which I detest, that I'm sure once we have to watch it, I can appreciate. So, to me, I love this character. Whether he's wearing underwear on the outside, I really don't care. If it's there, great. If it's not, I don't care. Like, it doesn't. I don't get bent out of shape. You know what I mean?
Let me just tell you. We were talking about Hot Toys earlier. I'm sitting here looking at my Hot Toys Christopher Reeve Superman, and I just last week placed the pre-order for the Henry Cavill Superman from Justice League. And I can't wait, man. I can't wait to have a shelf where both of those Supermans are standing back to back, because to me, it's a myth that encompasses all these versions.
And Zach, to me, and here's the point. Like, to me, first and foremost, what has to be portrayed properly and correctly is the character of Superman. Whether he's got a spit curl in the shape of an S, or, like I said, underwear or lack thereof on the outside of his costume, it's inconsequential to me. To me, is the character being portrayed the way that that he has been for the most part all of his existence, and is he an inspiration? And if he checks those boxes, then hey, he's got underwear on the outside, great. If he doesn't, that's great too. I'm good either way. So for this movie, I agree with Jordan that it inspired the superhero films we enjoy today, and I can watch it and appreciate it and love it on its own merits as well. And so for that, it's going to, again, I reiterate, a strong B+. And in saying that, I'm hopeful that we get another film with our current Superman. So
amen to that.
While I wait, I have no problem popping this in. By the way, I just want to, we didn't talk about it in the news, but before we close and give our social media plugs, what are your thoughts on the probability? Because there's a rumor, and it seems to be gaining traction, that Henry Cavill will appear in Shazam. What's your take on that?
Oh, I think that's great. You know, if Superman, first of all, let's keep him present in the universe, even if it's just even if it's a mention. Like, even if Henry Cavill doesn't appear, but they're like, oh, Superman is out there doing this. I'm happy with that. That at least we're. He's a presence in the universe. But if he is in fact in the movie and he serves as like an inspiration for Billy Batson, oh man, that's great.
He needs I would love that. And also what I'm the strong scuttlebutt is that we're gonna get a proper Superman sequel announcement at Comic-Con, and if Jordan was dancing over the Batman and Catwoman on a date of the wedding. if we get that announcement at Comic-Con and I'm reading about it online, I will videotape my dancing and share it on on Facebook and Twitter, even though I'll lose a lot of friends and followers from the dance. It is what it is. I'll be so happy that I'll do it. But yeah, let's you know, guys, let's stop. The thing that I want to caution, that I hope we can impart on Superman fans when they listen to this podcast, is look, Jordan has very different opinions than me and Zachy, but we didn't sit here for 2 hours and argue with each other or belittle each other's opinion. We had a discussion. We appreciated each other's likes and dislikes of this particular iteration of Superman, and we'll remain, you know, friendly and cordial beyond this, you know. And
absolutely.
I think that's the behavior that fans of this character, regardless of what interpretation you are, should maintain. Enough of this. Can we stop this infighting and all this craziness and boycotting another movie because it's Marvel?
Yeah, forget Marvel versus DC fans. We got a problem with DC versus DC fans.
Yeah,
sometimes.
Superman versus Superman fans. It's ridiculous. Like, come on, guys. Let's be better and let's live up to the inspiration that our favorite character and characters cause.
Amen to that.
I can hopefully impart on you. I don't want to get all Jerry Springer, but that's my final thought, minus all the chair throwing and everything else that goes along with that show. But that would be my final thought. Let's do the social media plugs. Zachy, if people want to get in touch with you and talk about Superman and or anything else, where can they do that?
Well, I'm on Twitter at Zachy's Corner. That's the AKIS Corner. You can also find me via the Movie Film Podcast, which I co-host with my partner, Brian Hall. And relevant to the discussion we just had, the Movie Film Show, we occasionally do movie commentaries. And we did full-length commentary tracks for Superman the Movie, Superman 4, and also Man of Steel, which I think if you guys haven't heard them, and also people in your audience haven't heard them, you might enjoy them if you found anything I had to say here of merit or worthy of your time.
I listened to the Man of Steel one; it was great, and I will.
Oh, thank you.
I will definitely go check out those other two, and I encourage everybody else to do the same. Jordan, if people want to talk about Batman and Catwoman's wedding date and what you'll be wearing that day, where can we find
you? Oh, absolutely. My Twitter page right now is. It's a lot of talk about their engagement and looking forward to their wedding. So I'm having a lot of fun talking about all that with everybody, and definitely want to keep talking about that because I'm so excited. July 4th can't get here soon enough. So you can find me on Twitter and on Instagram, actually at BatFanJordanV. And while I'm at it, I also want to solicit some iTunes reviews. So if you like what you're hearing from us, or if you don't like what you're hearing from us,
well, if you don't like it, most of it's today's episode and from Jordan, so send it his way.
Yeah. Oh, no, yeah, we might get some iTunes reviews that's like, this guy hates Superman the movie. I don't hate it. I love Otis.
Well, there's that. Every time you walk into an elevator, you must be thrilled. You get it? That joke may have gone over people's heads. But anyway, if you want to talk to me about anything regarding superheroes or whatever, you can find me at Superhero Sci-Fi, and we shout out the Batman on Film guys because we are a part of the because they're good guys, and also because we are a part of the Batman Podcast Network. So I want to throw that out there, even though today's episode was about Superman. Zachy, we'll be hearing from you again and speaking to you again when we start our Smallville retrospective, and we're excited for that.
Awesome, looking forward to it.
And for our listeners, until then. Have a great weekend and a great week. So long, everybody.
Batcat forever. Bye-bye.